Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is what exactly goes into a business exit plan and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. Pleasure to have you with me. You know, one of the things that we talk about here on Exit Coach Radio is a variety of financial strategies, because someday you as a business owner will likely liquidate your business, and then you'll have a pile of cash hopefully to do something with. And you're going to want to know what all different types of strategies are that you can both produce income and protect that wealth from the risks of the market and bad investments. So today with me are Anthony Fazzo and Cameron Christensen. They're founders of Infinite Wealth Consultants and hosts of the Infinite Wealth Podcast. Anthony and Cameron are passionate about empowering families and business owners to create passive income and build wealth without the risks of Wall Street. Welcome to the show, Anthony and Cameron.
Bill, thank you very much. I appreciate you having us on. This is Cameron, and my partner Anthony is just wrapping up a phone call, so he's walking over here right now.
Outstanding. Okay, thank you. Well, Cameron, welcome. Pleasure to have you with me. And, you know, I see that you've been a small business owner or had been for 8 years, and you're frustrated with investment solutions that we're getting pitched to you by traditional advisors. And so you discovered something called infinite banking and real estate investing. Tell us a little bit more, give our listeners a sense of you and your background and you know, what you do for folks.
Sure. So if you had to put us in a category, I'd say that we are financial advisors, but we don't take a typical approach. And the reason we don't take a typical approach is because we've seen some problems that kind of arise with the traditional mindset or traditional planning. Mm-hmm. And the whole reason that I even got into this industry is because I was a small business owner. Is I started out creating a small business, and I had a lot of success early. And I started looking at retirement options for myself. And what I realized was that really what was happening was I was separating myself from my capital, right? Every plan that was presented to me was, hey, let's go put your money into some sort of qualified or deferred plan. And I didn't have access to it till I was 60. I was a young man at that time, you know, 25 years old or so. And just that thought of putting money away where I didn't have access to it for 20 plus years just never sat right with me. And so I did what a lot of small business owners do, is I just sat on cash. And I just kind of sat there with the whole frustration and just kept looking around and like, man, you know, what else am I going to do? And I kept looking and kept looking, and then you just get frustrated with the amount of information that's out there. And what changed for me was a gentleman recommended a book, and it was a book, it was called Become Your Own Banker by Nelson Nash. And I read that book, and he handed this book to me, and he goes, if I would have read this when I was your age, I would have had additional millions of dollars, right?
Right.
And so
right.
I grabbed that. I read the book 3 times the first night, and I got pretty upset because it completely changed the way that I looked at money and building wealth. And what I did is I started practicing that myself. And then I started sharing that idea with other business owners that I knew. And then they kind of started coming to me for more suggestions. And that's really how I got into the business. It was more out of an obligation to kind of share some strategies that I found that were successful for me.
Yeah, that's great. You know, a lot of business owners are in a great position to use their business profits to build outside sources of wealth, but a lot of them just keep plowing money back into the business, and then they're really banking pretty heavily on cashing out on that equity down the road. I have met many, many business owners who did one thing smart. They invested in real estate, and that was in the building that they were operating their business out of. And a lot of times, it's not unusual for that building to be worth more than the business way down the road. So I think you're onto something here as far as, you know, diversifying, especially when you're when you have a lot of cash at an early age, and like you say, the traditional path of putting it away for a bunch of years, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
So, I'm glad you mentioned that. Is when you look at business owners and you kind of look at the kind of net worth ladder, when you look at somebody that's around $5 million, 60% of their assets are actually, you know what? Anthony's just walking in right now. Let me get him on here.
Hey, Bill, this is Anthony Fasco. CPA just walked in and joined us.
Hey, Anthony, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today. Cameron was right in the middle of you got our listeners on a cliff here, Cameron, so you better finish that story, and then we'll introduce Anthony properly.
Awesome. It's, what I was saying is you'd kind of touched on how business owners kind of acquire wealth, and what I was going to point out was as you climb that kind of net worth ladder for business owners, if you look at somebody that has a net worth of $5 million, 60% of their assets are liquid and 40% are typically illiquid. As they climb up that ladder and you look at somebody that has a net worth of $20 million, it's usually 40% of their assets are liquid and then 60% are illiquid. And illiquid is usually typically made up of real estate, like you just mentioned, and or a closely held business. And so the problem with a lot of the traditional planning that's out there is that the advisor is not addressing the illiquid side of it. And so as you climb that ladder in net worth, there's more and more of your estate that is being neglected by traditional advice.
That makes total sense, yeah. So Anthony Fasco, you are, first of all, a proud U.S. Army veteran. Thank you for your service. And a recovering CPA. I like that terminology. And you've worked at a world's largest accounting firm and served as a CFO of a chain of restaurants. That's quite a bit about your background. Tell us a little bit more about you and then how you and Cameron came together.
Well, I'll tell you about me. I'm happily married, have two kids, expecting my first grandchild. Ironically, the due date's April 15th.
That's all been changed, so maybe she'll be late.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, when I had my CPA firm, what really changed my life was what happened in 2008. And I saw the devastation. It happened to my clients, and it also happened to me. You know, my 401k turned into a 201k, like, overnight. And I saw what happened with my clients, and I was like, you know, I'm on that same path. I started doing some research and found that there's a financial crash or correction about every 10 years. I mean, there was 2008, 2000, the 90s, 80s, 70s. I mean, right now, I mean, the government's propping up the economy, and at some point when they stop, I'm anticipating another correction. So what I found is that if I continue to do the same thing, why would I expect a different result? And then I started looking for alternatives, and that's when I started noticing some of my clients did very well during that time. So I started asking them, what books are you reading? Like, what's your mindset? You know, what are you doing with your money? So I started practicing what they were doing, and then my clients were asking me what they should do. And I'm like, well, this is what I'm doing. And then that eventually created a business. And then I had two businesses, and I feel like I couldn't be an expert in both fields. So the choice was real easy. I sold my CPA firm probably about 6 years ago. And Cameron and I met on the same journey looking for alternatives to Wall Street and creating passive income. And we've been friends for over 10 years. And then a couple of years ago, we were both at the point, it's like, let's join forces. So that's when we started Infinite Wealth Consultants.
Very good. Thank you. So Infinite Wealth and your strategy, Infinite Banking, some of these ideas, can you just kind of paint us a broad brush picture of what a portfolio of some of your clients might look like as with regards to asset classes if they're not going into traditional investments, and I understand all the reasons about that. What are some of the other asset classes that you help them explore, and what are some of the goals and of your clients?
Yeah, great question, Bill. So what I would say is that the goal of the clients is always where we start, so I'm glad you threw that in there. And really what people are after is cash flow, right? And so traditionally, you know, business owners
right.
are looking to kind of have that big sale at the end of it, and then they're sitting on a pile of cash. And then the problem there is, how do I turn this cash into cash flow income for me? And so what we'll typically do is, we don't want to wait till the big sale, right, is we want to start to try to build cash flow before we get to that point. And so what we're actually doing is to kind of follow up with that stat I gave you previously, you're talking about the top three or top four kind of assets of high net worth individuals. It's usually real estate, closely held business, and then it's actually life insurance. And our focus is on that life insurance piece, but we don't focus on the death benefit, as we usually use that more so as an investment account. And we use mm-hmm. the loan capabilities of that cash value. And so what we'll do is we'll have clients reposition their assets into life insurance and that cash value specifically. And then what we do is we have them take loans against the cash value to buy more real estate, to buy more investments that create cash flow. And so we're not waiting until somebody's 65 to create income. We're going to start doing it right away for them.
Okay, so I'm going to address something. You just said the L word, life insurance. Cameron, and a lot of listeners
yeah.
don't understand the breadth and depth of the life insurance toolbox, you know, what's available in life insurance policies. And they think, you know, yeah, I've seen those. You put your money in and there's nothing there at the end of the year.
Yeah.
But there are policy designs that provide for high cash values relative to what you put into them and a death benefit, of course. But you get a lot of great tax benefits and loan provisions, abilities to use your money and pull out money, redeploy it in other ways, either pay back the loan or not. So there's a lot of provisions to it. I just want to clear that up for listeners that are saying, oh, life insurance, you know, I've seen it. I don't like it. For one reason or another, they may not have looked at it in the way that you're describing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I like to say, well, yeah, believe me, nobody wants to buy life insurance, okay? But what people do want is they want their money to be asset protected, to grow at a decent rate of return, ideally to be tax-free, and to have access to it. And what we do is there's what we say, or at least I say, I don't think Cameron said this, but I say this is not your mama's whole life insurance, right? Those are typically designed for death benefit. Well, just like you said, there's no cash value in there until maybe year four or five. But we design it very differently. We try to keep that death benefit as low as possible to try to get that cash value as high as possible. So there's cash value from day one. And in fact, with a lot of our clients, they're putting money into the policy on day one, so now it's asset protected and growing, and they're turning around 30 days later and deploying it to something. So what our view, the way, you know, you're right, there's a lot of facets to life insurance, and I like to say it's like it's a Swiss Army knife of finance. There's a lot of things that can accomplish. And the way we use life insurance is that it's not an either or. We're not saying put your money in life insurance or your business or real estate. That the way we do it and design it, this is an and asset. Put your money in life insurance and your business and real estate. And we can show you the math behind that. But by doing that, by running things through a policy, it's just like using a rewards credit card. Right, you use a rewards
okay.
credit card, you get some extra bonuses, right? Maybe miles, cash back, right? And you just add that one extra step, the rewards credit card. What we teach people, if you can understand a rewards credit card, you can understand infinite banking. But instead of adding that extra step as a credit card, that extra step is a policy. And then instead of getting miles, you are getting more money.
So these types of policies, you know, banks use them to accumulate, large corporations use them to accumulate, wealthy individuals with the best advisors use them to accumulate. There's something there. Let's get past the product and let's get towards the strategy. Walk us through,
yeah.
We have about 5 minutes left. Walk us through how this would work for someone. If you're telling someone for the first time, here's what you're going to do. You're going to put money into these insurance policies, and then you're going to redeploy that money. How? What are you going to do? Generally.
Generally. So we're talking to exit planning, right? Round exit planning, right? And so what I would end up doing with a lot of business owners that are looking to sell in maybe 5 to 10 years, what we'll do is we'll actually take some of those assets now today, and we'll use those assets to fund the life insurance policy. And when I say fund it, what we're going to do is we're going to use it to emphasize cash value, minimize death benefit, like Anthony just addressed. But really what we're going to do is we're just going to open up a bucket. And so what we can do is we can use some of those dollars now today to open up that bucket. So when somebody does sell their business, is now they have a place to put those dollars. And so now let's say somebody, you know, sells their business for $5 million and we've got a place to put $3 million of it. What we would do is we'd literally just take the $3 million and dump it into a life insurance policy. And now they can start drawing income off of that, and or we can do some of the lending and stuff that we just talked about a minute ago.
Okay, and there are some limitations as far as how much you can put into a life insurance policy without popping some of the great tax benefits that are available. So you need to work with tax advisors and legal advisors and financial advisors to properly, you know, you don't just dump $1 million in and that's that, right? You need to probably figure out your design properly to work within the guidelines and the rules of the IRS. I just want to make that clear.
You are right. Like you do need to make – this needs to be designed specially so this doesn't become taxable. But that's why there's some advantages of working with a recovering CPA. And when we design it, we've had people put in $1 million. And as long as it's designed properly, we can make sure that we're not going to violate any tax violations to make sure that this money – you're going to pay tax on the sale of the business, but the goal is, do you ever want to pay tax on those dollars again? And by putting them into a policy, they're going to be tax-free as long as you hold that policy.
So who's a good candidate to talk to you guys? Is there a minimum net worth or income level that is suitable for this type of a strategy? I want our listeners to be clear, you know, maybe they should be giving you a call, and maybe the demographics or the limitations just don't make sense.
I would say there's limitations. Yeah, the strategy is the same up and down the spectrum. But, I mean, I've got a kid that goes to UNLV that puts in $25 a month, and we've got clients that put in millions of dollars a year. If I'm totally honest, I would say somebody that makes less than probably $150,000 a year, it typically doesn't make a lot of sense for them. It's a little bit slower start. But if we're talking to business owners, this is probably one of the most well-kept secrets that business owners don't know about. And so if there's a business owner out there that's 50 to 65 years old that's approaching retirement and or considering a sale, absolutely they should reach out and we should have a conversation.
Yeah, the way that our business model works is very different than typical financial planners, because they will typically have a minimum, right? Because their business model is assets under management. The problem gets to be is a lot of business owners, they may have a high net worth, but it's all in the business. They're typically investing in the business, and they can make more money investing in themselves than investing in a mutual fund. So they may not have a lot of investable assets, but what that means is, you know, the good typical financial planners, the better they are, the higher their minimum is going to be. So there could be a business owner who makes a lot of money, but has a high net worth, but not a lot of investable assets. So he works with a typical financial planner. They're going to have to maybe work with somebody who maybe not as experienced as what they need. And with our business model, we don't have assets under management, so we don't need a we don't have a net worth or investment. balance requirement.
Excellent. So if you want to hear more, if you want to learn more about Anthony and Cameron, you can listen to their podcast. You guys have a podcast called Infinite Wealth Podcast, I understand. And also you have your website is infinitewealthcourse.com. And what would our listeners find at that URL? What would they find at infinitewealthcourse.com?
Yep, at that infinitewealthcourse.com, that's actually our course. We've got an online course that we typically charge $600 for, but for your listeners, what we'll do is we'll give them free access, and they can go to infinitewealthcourse.com/exitcoach, and we'll give them access to our course. Inside of there, they're going to look at some strategies and stuff that we suggest, and we're going to go into detail. We'll dive into some of the numbers and also provide some conceptual stuff as well. If they want to check out our website is actually infinitewealthconsultants.com.
You know, I will say, I believe that link or that backslash is infinitewealthconsultants.com/, not Infinite Wealth Course. But we will send you a link, so if you have the ability to put it in the show notes, that would be awesome.
Okay, excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining me today. There's a lot more we can talk about with this strategy, I'm sure. And I'd love to have you guys back sometime to continue our conversation. It's an interesting strategy, and we need to talk more about these types of topics. So thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you with me. And my next guest is coming back for, I think, the third time. I'm not sure, third or fourth time. This guy rocks. He rocks. He's not only is he a great website designer and strategist for marketing for business owners, but he plays guitar in a Santana tribute band that's really, really actually very good called Savor. And his band has performed for audiences as large as 6,000 people in more than 50 different cities in California, Arizona, and Nevada. Really good if you get a chance to check him out. But today we're going to talk about four ways that website design is like songwriting. Michael Karoff. Michael, thanks so much for joining me once again. How you doing?
Great to be here, Bill. Good to talk to you.
Same here. Let's see. So I covered some of it. I didn't talk about how you worked for Fender and started Frontline Magazine and then worked for the Phelps Group, a full-time advertising agency. And then Karoff Communications was born. Tell our listeners, just a general overview of what you do there. What are some typical engagements that you handle for your clients?
Absolutely. It's pretty straightforward. There are two sort of sides that are related. One is the website side, which most people understand what that is. You see a website, you operate them, you go to them, you have one maybe. So people understand that. The marketing side, which is SEO or search engine optimization and PPC, pay-per-click or Google Ads, it's a little bit more esoteric, but those are the two different things we do. And oftentimes for clients, we'll do them both together. Build the website, then drive the right kind of people there.
It makes sense that you would be involved in both sides of it since you're building the platform basically to start with, and then let's get people there and let's figure out who's coming and how we can turn them into good customers. So let me ask you a question. Is website design really like songwriting and how? Let's talk about that. What goes into writing a song?
Okay, so and you're right. They're more alike than you would think. Let's start with some songwriting things. The first point is creativity within a set format. When you write a song, you're not just willy-nilly putting anything out there. It's got to be a certain length. It's got to have lyrics that make sense to people. It's got to have a certain structure, verse, chorus. You know, it's got to have the same instrumentation. It's very rigid as far as what you can do. Within that, those bounds, you could be as creative as you want. The same thing with websites. You have to design for devices like computers and cell phones. You have to have text that's readable. You have to have photos that are going to fit in all formats. There are a lot of boundaries you have to stay within, and within those boundaries, you can also be as creative as you want.
So structure
that's
is really important.
Point.
Was it Don Henley that said, verse, don't bore us, get to the chorus?
Don't pour us get to the chorus, I think, is maybe older than dirt.
It probably is, okay. And the point there is you, the more that you say blah, 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 before you get to an offer, bring it back home and sum it all up and really get to the meat of the matter, the easier it is to lose someone, especially in this day and age of very, very small attention spans, right?
Absolutely, Bill. And it all comes to performing or creating for your audience, not for you. You know, in a song, people remember the chorus, that's what they glom onto. So, yeah, get them there. In a website, don't think about all the things that are important to you. Think about what is important to your viewers or your potential customers and make sure you give them that up front all the time.
And another point I would say about a song, the popular songs of our day, let's say, always had a lot of repetition at some point in the end, so the hook, right? So the audience would start singing along. The audience would get involved. Some of the best songs in the world out there got the audience singing along and participating in them, and that's really, you know, was the key to their success. Is that also true in websites in some way?
Yes, and you bring up a good word. Hook is something that every songwriter and musician knows. That means something that you hear that you remember long past when they hear the song. And so when the song comes up, yes, you're going to be singing along with it. Same with websites. If you can give them simple phrases or sound bites that people recall, they'll be much more likely to remember you, go back, and identify with what you do. Give them that first before you dive into all the nitty-gritty details.
Now, I got a question for you, Michael, and that is that, you know, I know with a lot of creative work and great, you know, design, that people can come to a website and become very impressed and say, wow, that's a great website. But I think the big question is, what can our listeners do to bring people back to their website on a repeat and periodic basis to build that familiarity and that relationship?
Absolutely. And again, the most important thing is to take yourself out of your body, if you can. Put yourself into the body and mind of your viewer. Think about it from their point of view. What's important to them may not be what's important to you. And it's important to give them what they're looking for. If you do, if you give them the information and all the facts that they need, they'll definitely come back. It's just, it's very rarely done. Most companies and website designers design egocentrically. They put out there what they think is important, and it often doesn't mesh with what their viewers think is important.
I'm wondering if a lot of our listeners might make a mistake that I see out there a lot, and that is they push a lot of content out in social media to try to, develop a relationship with someone, but they fail to they put it all out there. Let's say in the big three, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Let's say they put it all out there, and then but they don't link people. They don't bring people back to their website to deliver the main point of the message. Is that a big mistake? And what can people do about that?
Bill, it's an ironic that you bring that up. It's a double-edged sword. So you're right. In a perfect world, you'd want to always link back to your website to get people there. However, those social media channels don't want you to do that. They would prefer to keep people on their platform. So you have to make a balance. Some content you may just put on, let's say, a LinkedIn so that it comes up high in their search results and people see it. Some content you may want to get people back to your site. Every instance is different, but you have to understand the medium, and they don't want their viewers to leave.
I guess that makes sense for them, huh? Yeah. So when you're dealing with things like SEO, you know, we've heard over the years, and I've seen some of those, you know, the old holdover websites, the reason you can tell they're old holdover websites is they mention the city and maybe the surrounding cities 100 times in the text, because that used to be how SEO triggered where to maybe emphasize your website, right? But that's all changed. What do you think when you see those old types of websites like that?
They're 15 years old. The techniques you talked about are literally that far back. Yeah, that hasn't worked for quite a while. Really, it comes down to creating content that the user is going to find valuable. And Google, I use Google because they're the big gorilla, they understand what people find value, and their algorithm can sense if you are what they call spamdexing, spamming the keyword index. If you're spamdexing, it's going to be counterproductive. If you write naturally for things that people will find valuable, then that will get you high in the search engines and also appeal to your audience.
And for, I think, maybe it's 5 or 10 years ago, the thing was to put some kind of a content, videos, audio, something that buzzes a little bit onto your website that interacted. Is that old news too, or is that still relevant when you're designing a website?
Not at all. That's very relevant. Yeah. Video, in fact, is huge. And the only thing I would advise people against, and I very rarely see this anymore, is when they come to your website automatically playing a video or audio file, you let them click on it if they want to see it. But other than that, yes, video is very powerful because it will, first of all, engage people at least as much as text will when they're there. And it tends to keep people on pages longer, which has a subsidiary effect of making Google rank your page higher because they think that it's more relevant. People are staying there longer. So yeah, video is very powerful.
And I've heard one of the key tenets in building anything on the internet is don't make us think when it comes to the consumer. Don't make us think too hard. But is it what I've been noticing is more of a trend towards one long page for websites. So is the new rule don't make us click?
No, I actually disagree with that. Pretty strongly. And if we're talking about a site, a single page site, which you have been seeing, where it's all on one page and you just scroll up and down and you click and it takes you down there, that's death for SEO. However, you can certainly have a long page, especially with the home page. People are used to scrolling. They'll scroll down, but I wouldn't make them stay on one page. I wouldn't keep everything on one page.
So is that because you can put is it meta tags into each individual page and that enhances your abilities in SEO or your visibility?
This isn't your first rodeo, is it, Bill?
I've been talking to you for many, many years, Michael. That's everything I learned. but I'm just wondering, trying to figure out the why behind that.
Yeah, that is because you have multiple pages where you can put multiple meta tags, URLs, everything. Yeah.
So when you think about it, that gives you more irons in the fire, if you will, and more guitars in the band.
More cowbell.
More cowbell. There you go. You have more cowbell. So tell us what do you think the next – what's the next wave in website design? What are you keeping your eye on as far as the upcoming changes, or have we done all we can do in that area?
I wouldn't say we've done all we can do. I think that we're going to start seeing more embedded of advertising. So, for instance, if you go to a website, you could sort of see a lot of times an ad at the top or the side. Whereas you're going to start seeing more ads that are embedded into the content, so it's more difficult to tell it's an ad. It's more integrated with the content on there. I've been seeing that happening for a while, and I can see that definitely continuing. Other than that, one of the points that I make in songwriting is like website design is try to stay away from being too trendy because then you get caught up. An example I use is, remember the hits from the 70s and 80s, disco and new wave? How many of those are still big now? But you look at a timeless classic like Eric Clapton's Layla, which came out just as long ago. It still sounds relevant, and that's because he didn't write it to fit the current trends. So same thing with website. Use trendy things sparingly, and only use the ones that really make sense, not just because they're hot.
Good point. So I guess your goal is to create a classic website, right? That's always always beautiful, always relevant, always in tune. And the SEO side, I guess, you know, Google's going to do what Google's going to do. You just have to stay relevant as far as that's concerned. Do you go back with your past clients and say, hey, Google's changed everything. You know, we need to refresh and update certain things. Maybe not the website design. It looks great, but we need to update some of the ways we tag things and to be relevant with the Google's new systems.
I don't usually go back to clients. They usually come to me and say, hey, we've noticed that since you stopped working on our SEO, it's been slipping. What can we do? And a lot of it is just a matter of continuing to add new content. That's a big part of what Google is looking for. Yes, there are some down and under the hood techniques that you can use, and they do change from time to time, but none of that is even approaches the importance of constantly well-written, fresh content. If you have that, you're going to stay fairly evergreen as far as Google is concerned.
How about on the shopping side of a page, not just that, you know, give us more information or tell us something, when someone creates a merchant type of a site, does you get involved with that as well?
We do. Yes, we do.
Okay.
And
so my question,
the key there – oh, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
The key there is making it user-friendly, and the king, as we all know, is Amazon. You know, they make it very easy for the user to buy. It's just that it takes millions of dollars worth of, you know, research and design and programming to make it that easy.
Right, right. And one of the things that Google is very, very good at is the cross-sell. You know, customers who bought this also are interested in X, Y, and Z, right, the cross-sell. And I was going to say that one of the best cross-sell sites I think that's always been out there has been Vistaprint. They bug you to death if you buy a business card. They want you to buy a mouse pad and a car banner and all kinds of different things. They must give you like five or six offers on the way to the checkout stand, which is a little bit aggravating after a while. But it must work because they still do it. Amazon basically uses a more soft sell approach and says, hey, you bought this. Maybe you'd be interested in this, this, and this, as others are. Is that just so important these days for business owners who are going it on their own and trying to compete against these types of companies?
It would be if you had the resources, but again, I go back to the fact that how Amazon makes it look so easy for the customer is an incredible amount of work on the back end. So I think you can do some things like that in smaller level e-commerce sites, but you'll never approach that sophistication they have. And again, it's different for each customer. You know, it depends on what you're selling and how often you can cross-sell. But you can also follow up sales with simple things like, you know, auto-generated email to say, hey, thanks very much for buying this. By the way, people that bought that also have this. So there's a few less robust ways to do it that can also be effective.
Michael, you've been in front of as many as 6,000 people playing your guitar. Do your fingers still work as easily in front of 6,000 people as they do in front of 600?
In some ways, I prefer the smaller crowds because it's a little bit more intimate. But yeah, it's pretty much the same skill set either way.
Well, you're paying tribute to a great band, and I'm sure a lot of people have high demands, and you guys certainly do not disappoint. And I've seen some of your videos; they're very, very good, very good. So keep up the good work there, and congratulations on all your success. Are there any tips you'd like to leave our listeners with that they should be thinking about when they go back and look at their website after listening to this?
Yeah, I've got one that I really push a lot, and oftentimes there's restriction, and that is, the web is cold, it's remote. Make it personal. I don't mean that you have to give people your social security number and your kids' birthdays. I mean, talk about yourself, what your interests are, put, you know, more candid photos. Sometimes step back a little bit from the uber professional and let people get to know you. I think that's incredibly powerful on websites.
That's great advice, especially we're in this new kind of more informal world where you can be on a business meeting on Zoom and your dog walks behind you and, you know, it breaks up the breaks up the crowd. So maybe the world's become a little bit more informal and your website should reflect that as well. Michael, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming on today. It's really a pleasure to talk with you again, and I wish we were sitting face-to-face, but this will have to do.
Me too, Bill. Thanks again.
All right, thank you. And thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to have you here. We have a great lineup of guests today, and my next guest is going to tell us a little bit about what it's like to own and work with a franchise group. Brinson Smith is the director of franchise sales at U-Break iFix, an electronic device repair franchise, and I'll let him tell you the rest. Brinson, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
My pleasure. And you're calling in, what, from it looks like a Florida area code. Is that right?
I am. I'm calling in from Orlando, Florida. Absolutely. Where are you located, Bill?
Good old Orlando. If you take your finger and put it on a map halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles on the coast, that's where I am, exactly.
Nice.
Halfway in between. Nice. San Luis Obispo area, Avila Beach is a little town I'm in. Great spot. And
nice.
Then I grew up in South Florida in Boynton Beach and Delray Beach. So
okay.
I know Orlando very
yeah.
well. It's a great spot. So tell us a little bit about
awesome.
You and your background. And really, I guess, how did you get into the world of franchises? What did you do before that? And what gave you kind of the idea, you know, I think I want to do this with my life?
Yeah, good question. So actually, it came into the company through my lovely wife. My wife is her best friend is the founder's wife of U-Break iFix, and I got to know our founder and CEO Justin Weatherall really well back in around 2012 when I met my wife. And his concept was so interesting that I was looking, actually at the time when I met Justin, I was looking to franchise myself. I was looking at businesses that were, I would call Amazon proof. I had worked through the 2008, 2009 Great Recession. So I was looking for something also that was recession proof, service-based business ideally. And I was really enamored with U-Break iFix once I met Justin. And I was about to move forward with two franchise locations in Orlando, and as convincing as Justin is, he basically convinced me to stay at U-Break and hired me instead. So I came on board with U-Break iFix actually back in 2014. We had somewhere around 55 to 60 locations at the time, and yeah, still here. So it's been a fun ride over the last 7 years.
So to put matters in perspective, our listeners are typically business owners age 50-plus who are maybe considering the exit of their business
sure.
in the next few years, and oftentimes considering just a change in their life. Maybe they don't
sure.
want to necessarily retire as much as they want to rewire, right? So they just want to change
right.
things
I
up.
I like that.
And as they look for other opportunities, one of the opportunities that likely wasn't available when they started their first business many years ago was a franchise operation.
Right.
And so
right.
What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is to have you kind of just for those who have never approached looking at a franchise, but they've looked maybe at other businesses to acquire that are personally owned businesses, right? So what's the big
right.
difference when you approach someone to say, hey, why don't you look at a U-Break iFix? What's in your pitch book, if you will? What can you offer someone that might want to look at buying a business as a franchise as opposed to Joe's Plumbing?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think it's a fair question. I think you know, when you start a business from scratch, you know, I think there's a bunch of different opportunities out there. There's a bunch of different ways to take a product to market. But when you look at taking a product to market, franchising is basically a vehicle to do that. And, you know, one of the reasons why I love franchising is the franchisor can essentially, you know, partner up with people that have relationships in their community. They know their market. They know their area. They have the capitalization to move forward. And it gives the franchisor the ability to really support and pour into that franchisee and help catapult them much quicker, as opposed if that franchisee was moving forward with the business on their own, especially going into a new industry or a new space. You know, our space, to give you an example, there are a lot of different franchises out there that you could start, businesses that you could start, and you could look at it and go, well, I could start this business over here, but I could franchise. But really, what are the benefits of franchising? I could do this myself technically. What are the pros and cons? And I think when you look at a business like You Break, I Fix, to give you an example, we have partnerships throughout the U.S. that somebody starting their business from scratch just could not attain. They couldn't get them. You know, we're partnered with Samsung. We're partnered with Google. We're partnered with Asurion. So we have tons of business every single month that we're pushing into our franchisee owners' doors, where franchise owners, they're not doing anything to receive that business other than, you know, flying the banner, flying the flag, the You Break, I Fix banner. And that's pretty cool, the fact that we're able to push that much volume into the franchisees' doors. I think that's a really big part of looking at franchising is what does the partnership landscape look like? And what does that corporate support look like? And you actually, made me think with your question about our owner group. Like, we have a lot of owners in our system that have multi-unit franchising experience. You know, they're diversifying their portfolio. But believe it or not, the majority of the owners in our system, I call corporate refugees, people that, you know, have a career, 10, you know, 20, 30-year career in corporate America. They're looking to, you know, not necessarily retire, but maybe retire from a corporate gig and mm-hmm. you know, build a business going into their, you know, as you mentioned, their 50s and 60s and potentially sell it, you know, look at an opportunity on the back end to, you know, to sell that business or pass it on as like a legacy business to their children. So I think franchising makes a lot of sense for people that kind of fall into that corporate refugee category, because you know, when you franchise a business, you're buying into a business that has, if you're buying into the right franchise, you're buying into a business that has recognition, it has scale, people are aware of the brand, there's a lot of value there. And on the back end, I think smart money looks at what does it cost to get into the business, but if I ever sell this thing on the back end, what does that look like as well? And I think franchising is definitely a good thing to look at, you know, on that front. So hopefully that
very
helps.
Good point. Yeah. No. So you have you said a mouthful there. So, Brinson, you're talking about you know you're capturing the capital letter branding, okay? Which is
right.
You've been at work at franchise headquarters, being these huge relationships that if I started on my own to, you know, Bill's Fix It, there's no way I'm going to get those. And plus, I don't want them because it's probably going to overwhelm me, you know, if I got a Samsung account or a Sarian, like you said. So that's the big B of branding. Now, of course, I'm going to be working on the little B of branding in my local area as well, but with the tools that you've developed at headquarters. And secondly is it's a known and tested model and commodity, and I'm catching it midstream, not from the beginning, rolling something up the hill. And that gives me the ability on the back end to get out of it.
Correct.
As well. So I think those are all huge points. And then, you know, when I get the franchise, I don't just get a pat on the back and good luck. I get a big, pretty, like a, I want to say the box, right? The box, the business
Correct.
In the box, we all call franchises, which has, like you said, other owners that you probably have a discussion or forum or support group that you can get the best practices from other owners. What else? What other types of support would people expect to get?
Yeah, and I think the best thing for all the listeners to know is, we meet our franchisees where they're at. You know, we have a lot of franchisees that come in, and again, they've, you know, we've got a gentleman in our system today that has a, you know, 100 plus hair salons, and got another owner that has over 100 Verizon stores. And, you know, so there are owners in our system that are very sophisticated. They have a lot of experience, and they might need less handholding right out of the gate. That's okay. But on the flip side, we could have a brand new owner that, you know, they've worked for a company for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, or it could be a younger owner coming out of college, partnering with their, you know, their father, something like that. And it's a new venture for them. And, you know, everything's brand new. So, you know, a good franchise is going to meet the franchisee where they're at, and they are going to supply the training wheels on the bike. They're going to support you through the opening process. One of the, you know, to give you an example of that, real estate is a new thing for a lot of people. You know, signing a commercial lease, I will say that we are in a better environment right now today for a new franchisee to enter into a retail type franchise business. When you look at just the lease landscape, it is, the pandemic has really flipped the landscape from a landlord dominated market to really more so a tenant dominated market. So there's a lot of negotiables and things that we're able to do. So it's actually a really good time. And our business in general, when you look at the pandemic, you know, our business is significantly up. You know, when you look at 2020 versus where we were prior years, our business actually did very well throughout 2020. It was very resilient. And that's a positive thing. So again, to get to the point I was trying to make is a lot of our owners have never signed a lease before, and they've never navigated that whole build out process and how that works. So we're there to hold our owner's hand through the process and again, supply that support through the process. Everything from getting the store open to once the store is open, we have operational, you know, training support. And then we have an operational business team that's assigned to the franchisee stores as well. That's there to look at, you know, the P&L and make sure the business is all the different indicators and KPIs that we look at to make sure that we're supporting the franchisee through that process. So there's really support on the front end, also on the back end. And again, we like to meet our owners really, you know, where they're at and give them the support that they need based on their background and experience.
Let me hit you with a question that I would think some of our listeners might be thinking of. And that is, you know, if I had a Subway, for instance, I'll just use another big, you know, franchise name.
Sure.
And if I had a Subway and my sandwich makers all called in sick, I think I could probably go down there and I'd have a miserable long day, but I could probably make sandwiches. But if my technicians get sick, I don't know how to fix a radio or a cell phone or a computer. does that give anybody pause for thought? It's like, you know, I don't know about the working in it. I don't want to really work in it. I want to own the thing in the first place. But how do you? I'm sure you get that question from some people. What are your answers to that?
Yeah, and to be candid, the first time I ever got that question was in really 2020, due to, you know, the environment in 2020. And there were some stores across the country and in retail in general, right? Like everybody was impacted, by COVID. Right. And you know, we did have some stores where an employee gets sick and, you know, he, you know, has a cough or something like that. And then the other employees are like, oh man, Timmy has a cough. Well, I'm not going to come in today. And that was just a situation that everybody dealt with, whether you were a Subway or whether you were, you know, in the food space, you were a retailer, you're Best Buy, it doesn't matter the retailer. Everybody was dealing with, you know, employee issues, especially at that time. Things have gotten a lot better now. And in fact, in general, like I've talked to pretty much most of our owners through 2020 and most of our owners, you know, they'd have an employee or two that would call out, they got sick, they'd go get tested, which is the right thing to do. But it wasn't a situation where the whole, you know, typically the whole store is just saying, hey, we're not coming to work today. You know, that's very uncommon. But I guess to answer your question, let's say you had a scenario where, you know, all your employees said they're not going to show up to work. You know, that would be one of those things where you, the owner, could go in. We do encourage our owners to have an understanding of, you know, the process, the repair process, how everything works. But at the same time, in our system, you do not have to be an owner that does repair. We have a lot of owners that have other businesses, and they don't repair devices, but they do understand our product. They do understand the service. And I always recommend our owners go in. Our training system is really top-notch. And go in with an open mind, even if you're not a techie person. At least learn the business and understand it, even if you're not doing repairs, because it helps you hold your employees accountable. It helps you just run a better business. So, yeah, it would be tough. Like, if all of your employees just decided they weren't going to show up, that would be tough, I think, in any business. I mean, even if you were running a Subway, like, I think it would be challenging as the owner, right?
Yes, yeah. My point was, and you brought it up too, is that you have a training program, and I'm sure there are, you know, I mean, look, if you lost all your employees in a sandwich shop, you can teach people how to make a sandwich pretty quickly, right? I mean, people go through a revolving door. Is it more difficult finding, or are there a lot of young people out there that are looking for, that have this technical abilities to work in a You Break, I Fix? And how detailed is the training program, I guess?
Yeah, good question. I think one other thing to add to that too, most of our owners are multi-unit franchise owners. So when you have, you know, when you have two locations, to give you an example, or three, it's easy for you. Like, let's say you had an employee issue. What typically happens is owners will pull employees from one location and they will move them to the other. When you just only have one location in any franchise, it puts you in a different position because you're reliant on everything within the four walls. So I like multi-unit opportunities where owners come in and they do two or more because, you know, you can share parts and people, and I think there's a benefit there.
Right.
But to answer your question, most of our employees, and this is kind of, I guess, crazy to think about, we don't hire for the tech background, meaning when we're hiring our employees, we're not placing ads out there saying electronic repair technician wanted. And one of the reasons why we don't do that is we found that a lot of times when you're hiring people that have prior electronic repair experience, they have bad habits. A lot of times they're stuck in their ways. And I don't want to stereotype here, but sometimes when you're looking at really techie people, sometimes they lack the customer service experience and the ability to connect with the customer. And you have to put yourself in the shoes of a customer walking in. I've got two kids. I have a toddler, and my toddler actually just broke one of my devices not long ago. And, you know, when my toddler throws my device off the wall and I've got a shattered iPhone, I'm walking into the You Break, I Fix. I'm not upset at You Break. You know, I'm not mad. I'm not really frustrated with them. I'm more relieved that they're in my market and can serve me. But I'm also not walking in fist pumping like I would be if I was going to eat, a burrito at Chipotle. Right? Like, it's just a different experience. So having that person, and this really, to answer the question, we hire people with customer service experience, people that might have been a hostess at a Cheesecake Factory, a background at AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint. They've worked at Best Buy. Believe it or not, our founder, Justin Weatherall, was a blue shirt at Best Buy. He worked at Best Buy prior. And then one of our co-founders worked for 7 years prior at Circuit City. So, you know, having that experience, being able to make eye contact with the customer. And one other thing, you made me think of this with the Subway analogy. Subway is going to see, you know, if you're looking at a Subway or a Zaxby's or a Starbucks or, you know, a business, they're going to get a lot of high volume, anywhere from 400 to 1,200 customers today with an average ticket, usually under 10 bucks. In our business, we're going to see anywhere from 15 to maybe 60 customers a day. So the average ticket is significantly higher than that. and the interaction with that customer is much longer. So it's really, again, important for us to have somebody that has that background in customer service. And I guess one other thing to say here that I think is important, when you look at most franchise businesses out there, most franchises, the 2,000 plus different franchise opportunities on the IFA website, most of them are hiring millennials. Like, it's just when you look at the job, the force of millennials out there, that's where most of the hiring is going to be, depending on what the franchise concept is. Most millennials grew up playing Sega Dreamcast, Xbox, PlayStation,
right.
They grew up with a cell phone. So they're techie people by default. Even if a millennial can't fix a phone walking in, they're
good
users
point.
Of tech. They understand it and they learn very, very quickly. And they're also not going to go home at the end of the day. And I'm not knocking, food, but they're not going to go home smelling like a hamburger or pizza or, they're in an air-conditioned environment, right? And I think that's a huge, a huge plus for a lot of people that, young people that are looking for a job, maybe right out of college or something like that. So,
Excellent. Excellent points. You really turned into a very interesting interview, and it's an interesting idea for a franchise, and I wish you all the best of luck. And for listeners, if you want to get in touch with Brinson, you can email him at b.smith@ubreakifix. That's the letter U, break, B-R-E-A-K. The letter I, and fix, F-I-X, ubreakifix.com, or franchising at ubreakifix.com, or call them at 321-445-8810. It's been a real pleasure to have you on. I've learned a lot, and I think our listeners have too, and I wish you the best of luck with ubreakifix.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Bill. And Bill, quick correction. If any of the listeners do want to email me directly, it's b.smith. I just didn't want you guys to send an email to b.smith and nothing gets to me. So it's just b.smith@ubreakifix.com. Thanks so much, Bill, for having me.
Excellent.
Much appreciated.
Thank you, and thank you for listening today. It's been a real pleasure to have you all with us. Hope to catch you again here at Exit Coach Radio next week.
Hey everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on exitcoachradio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.